tonight, we're going to give you, free of charge, one more issue of the technical net. This will be technical net number 1608 of the series that began in September of 1982, 33 and a fraction years ago. I believe that this is one of the longest running nets in hours and years under one, essentially one leadership. You'll also be hearing tonight space report from Paul WS2N, space report number 207 of the series. This weekend was one of the high holy days of ham radio, field day. Let me drop. And if you go to the proper ARRL website, you can see a picture of Long Island and New Jersey and Connecticut and a whole bunch of red teardrop-shaped things showing you where each one of the registered, so to speak, field day operations were taking place. My son, Christopher, KV2IQN, and I had a chance to visit a number of them. I went to three field day sites visiting people. My first one was Lockfield for about an hour or two, followed by Lima for a few hours, followed by Great South Bay. And altogether, I got this darn many interesting conversations. In other words, people who found out that a TechNet person was there started asking some really deep questions. Apparently, some of these people were saving up questions until they had a face-to-face contact with the TechNet people, so to speak. So, boy, I got into so many exciting conversations with so many people that I ended up staying up around the clock. Let me drop it. Some of the hams who participate in TechNet consider it a day away from home, camaraderie with the guys, ham radio, setting up antennas, all kinds of transmitters and receivers. The actual competition itself is, to some people, not the major function. It's the face-to-face interfacing between people, comparing war stories as to what antennas and what transmitters and what receivers and what propagation worked. And so, like I said, I ended up staying up around the clock. A few people do that. They get so excited by the whole thing. In fact, I was with Gizbark from roughly midnight to 2 or 1 in the afternoon the next day, continuously talking to people. And some of those were interesting conversations. Got all kinds of notes I made as to further information that should be exchanged between me and other people. So, field day, if you've never attended one of those, should. And by way of that map at ARRL, you can find out each year where the nearest groups are, what their names are, who their contacts are, where they're located. Gizbark, for instance, had a crane-like device that went to something like 85 feet. Amazing. And with a mast sticking out of the top of that with antennas coming out of it. Limark also had quite a number of towers in interesting ways that they set them up. One of the things Limark did is to set out a very large tarpaulin on the ground. And at first I couldn't figure out what that was. Let me drop it. I think the tarpaulin is where all of the antennas were assembled before putting them on the mast, before putting them on the towers. And by this tarpaulin, if any screws and bolts and things like that, parts that dropped, they wouldn't get lost in the grass. They're dropping under the tarpaulin. Pretty crafty idea. That's what I think was going on. Heard some very quiet 2 kilowatt and more generators. Honda makes some really nice generators for in use at a number of these field day sites. So we'll be discussing more of that. Hopefully people who are not quite as crazy as I was, staying up around the clock, maybe they're awake tonight and they'll give us some of their reports as to what the field day was like for them. Later on I'm going to be passing it around saying, what did you see at field day? Did any of the big ones get away? DX contracts, I guess, or people that you wanted to talk to. The TechNet, let me drop. It's a gathering of a clan of people who have a real curiosity, interest in radio, wireless, computers, space, any of the subjects of interest to ham radio operators are allowed to be discussed on the TechNet. And we get some pretty deep ones sometimes. We get very loose schedule. The first hour, we take people who check in who do have a question or a comment, and we take those in sequence. It's supposed to heavy subjects. But there were times where the first section lasts for a whole 2 hours. That's followed by John KC2WGB, who maintains the email, the write-in. All of a sudden, I can't think of the right words for them. You know what I mean? People who want to write to the TechNet because they've got a question or a comment, and yet don't have the right mailbag, don't have the right equipment to talk to us directly, or the right license yet, and they're working on that. So John chooses 2, 3, 4 of those of general interest, and we discuss them. That's followed by Paul, WS2N, our space expert. He'll be giving us space report number 207 tonight. NASA and the other European space agencies and Asian space agencies are always doing interesting things. Let me drop. I'm probably asking Paul the usual corny question, what is that really far-reaching, the longest DX contact of a QRP rig in the world is Voyager. Voyager is out there 12 billion miles at the speed of light. It takes 17 hours for the signal to go one way. You say, hello, Voyager, how you doing? 17 hours out, 17 hours back, 34, 35 hours later, you get an answer from Voyager. 10-watt QRP transmitter, three times the distance of Pluto, 12 billion miles away. Is that DX? The path loss between Voyager and us here on Earth is something like 315 decibels. You write down the ratio of the power it transmits versus the power that you receive if you were using isotropic antennas. It's 1 divided by 10 with 31 zeros after it, or 33. Yeah, for having 31 zeros. Big ratio. Try to simulate that amount of insertion loss in a laboratory. You can't come close. I mean, the best double-shielded coax cable you can use has only got 100 or so dB of shielding. Let me drop. So you can only get 100 dB shielding out of a double-shielded piece of coax cable with real good connectors, and you're trying to simulate an insertion loss of 315 dB, and the signal reaching out of your double-shielded cable with good connectors is only 100 and some odd dB down, you can see the numbers are just out of sight. So that Voyager is something else. And it looks like Voyager will be able to talk to us, I am guessing, for 10, 15, maybe 20 years. It's running on a nuclear power supply. And I think the funding for NASA to aim the dish and collect the data at Voyager, I think the funding is going to run out before that power supply, the nuclear power supply, runs out. That thing is capable of talking to us long distance into the future. It's outside of our solar system. It's not even seeing solar wind anymore. It's now starting to see galactic wind and reporting to us what it sees out there. Temperature, winds, and whatever. Charged particles. What a project that was. Launched in 1977. And so, that DX. And so, QRP DX, you ain't going to be able to top that one. Can we drop? So that's one of my favorite subjects. When it comes to people who can't stay up as late as the segment runs, it runs from 8 o'clock till midnight. For the last 33 years, most of that time is running that time. There's a very enthusiastic guy in New Jersey, Mike Perry, KC2NJI, who records all of the TechNets and puts them on a website. The website is www.amateurradio.tangovictor. Amateurradio.tangovictor. You go there, the last 10 years of TechNet are all recorded. Select the right year, the right month, the right week, and start playing back that data for people who can't stay up so late. So, Mike these days is putting the TechNet on that website a couple of days after Sunday, like maybe Monday or Tuesday of this week, it'll be there. So with some people who can't stay up until midnight will download that into their recording device, play it while they're on the train, while they're traveling to work on their noon hour or whatever, if they want to listen to the TechNet, where they can't stay up till the crazy hours that we stay up. Let me drop them. And sometimes we stay up some... I stayed up around the clock going to these field day sites over this last weekend. I did something almost as crazy last weekend where I stayed up real late and couldn't think of Hal's call letters or name. His name and his call letters, K6DPZ, Hal, who sometimes gives us the quick cancer. Couldn't think of his name, couldn't think of his call letters. I just said, hey, you, go ahead and talk to us. My mind went blank. Okay, one other website, that's mic number one I talked about, is amateurradio.tv. K1MJM, mic number two, from Connecticut, has another website that has relevant data for the TechNet, and that's at LimarkTechNet.com. LimarkTechNet.com. There you'll see pictures of antennas and the other articles, and graphs, and whatever, things related to the TechNet that you might want to visit and bring yourself up to date, so to speak. As I said before, it's the curious people who want to know about more about radio. Let me drop it. That's the kind of people who gather at the TechNet. It is my opinion that our colleges, our schools, are doing a less than mediocre job of teaching the wireless technology, radio technology, in a user-friendly form. They've got a curriculum they set in 1948, and they haven't changed it very much ever since at most of those schools. So if you really want somebody who knows how to design antennas and radios and receivers, you probably have to hire a ham radio operator. Arguably the most reproduced piece of electronics on planet Earth are so-called cell phones and smartphones. Cell phones themselves, 6.8 billion of them, are in operation right now. The majority, a very large portion of that development took place by way of a ham radio operator. Dr. Reed Fisher, W2CQH, Charlie, Quebec Hotel, at Bell Laboratories, roughly 1969. He was a 432 operator. I was talking to him two or three times per week for a number of those years at that time. Him in New Jersey and me on Long Island. We had both built ourselves a 432 transmitter. Let me drop. He's not the only person, but from my point of view, from what I know about the surface, about that particular project, he was one of the major contributors to the design and concept of what we now know as a cell phone, 6.8 billion of them. There's a couple of television programs in the last week, in fact, one, 2 days, that reiterated the fact that there are more people on planet Earth with a useful cell phone they can get to compared to the number of those people who can find a working toilet. And the ratio is huge. In other words, mankind has discovered that cell phones, in their opinion, seem to be more valuable than working toilets. Almost every human being, I think there's 7 billion people on planet Earth and 6.8 billion cell phones. The United States has something like 98% coverage. In other words, you look at the population and the number of cell phones, it's 98%. There are a number of countries. You go to the right website, you can see the list of countries, their population, and the number of cell phones. A number of countries have close to 200% coverage of cell phones. In other words, twice as many cell phones in that country versus population. Let me drop it. You ask Google who invented the cell phone. For years, the answer you got is Martin Cooper. He was the man at Motorola who, in 1973, had put together a complete cell phone working system with Motorola hardware. He had this handy talkie-like thing that was quite a few pounds in his hands, where you could dial telephone numbers. And near New York City, he had set up a cell site. He created a photo opportunity where he collected a bunch of newspaper reporters and say, "Watch what I'm about to do." And he calls his buddy at Bell Laboratories, who was working on cell phone development, and said, "Guess where I am and guess what I'm doing." So for a number of years, Martin Cooper was considered the inventor of cell phones. Now, you go to the right websites, and he is softening that opinion. He doesn't call himself the inventor. He calls himself the first person who used and made a working system out of cell phones. And a number of other people at Bell Labs really did that development work, from my point of view, and not getting very much credit for it. But that is the most reproduced piece of radio electronics that I know of on planet Earth. What a project that has turned into. And now you get people who are text messaging each other. You can get groups of students sitting alongside to each other, text messaging to each other, because they like that mode of communication rather than talking face-to-face, if you know what I mean. It has that much of an impact on our society. Let me drop it. And you could say some of the real first cell phones were really ham radio operators who would put a touch tone pad into their handy talkie and hooked up a phone patch at their local Eagle repeater way back in, the late 60s. You could have the right kind of a touch tone pad on your handy talkie and go to a phone patch, hook up at your local repeater, and dial yourself into the telephone system. So ham radio was heavily involved in the development of that product from my point of view. It's a beautiful example of the fact if you want a real radio scientist, you probably have to handle, hire a ham radio operator that's the only guy who has, let me drop it, the only guy who has the hands-on experience of building radios, transmitters, and receivers, and hooking up antennas and feed lines and making that system work at the user-friendly level. And so a number of the hints and things that they've, the number of the rules of thumb that they've come to use was not learned from their school, not learned from their professors, not learned from their books. It was learned from the real world of doing it. And so I think the United States has, what is it, something like 750,000 licensed ham radio operators. Something like one ham radio operator per 500 in the general population of the United States. A number of the other fully developed nations have approximately that ratio, one per 500. That makes us oddballs. Let me drop. But it's a very educated group of oddballs, if you know what I mean. Curious that also, when it comes to private pilots in the United States, there's roughly one of those per 500 in the general population. But places like Canada and United Kingdom and Europe Japan and Asia and Australia, the developed nations have roughly one per 500 ham radio operators per the general population. Unfortunately, that number is a little bit on the low side. Therefore, quite often your community won't understand why you're putting up an antenna, why you're putting up a tower, and because that's something they've heard about. A brand new neighbor moved in close to my house, and I walked over and told them about why is there a tower on that piece of property. And I said, in case you get curious about that, that's my ham radio antenna. And so this person, a very well-educated person, said, what is hand radio? H-A-N-D. I said, ham radio. She heard the word hand radio, H-A-N-D, radio. She had never heard of ham radio before. And so we had quite a conversation. And I bet you that situation is not unique. Okay, enough of the gab. You guys are going to give me your call letters and name because you're signing in because you do have a question or a comment. Let me drop. So when you sign in, if you do have a question or a comment, you're going to give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, reconfirming you got a question or a comment. You need not sign in simply because you're listening. Don't need a great big long list of people telling me they're listening. KE2EJ has hooked up this repeater system called Lima with IRLP, Echo Link, and a chat room. So in theory, people with, in other states and other countries can listen, can sign in. If you have trouble signing in because we're too quick on the key and your Echo Link can't get through, John monitors it, KC2WG monitors that website. And he knows about it and he'll inform us, so you'll get through. So don't give up. Well, as I said, with that kind of coverage, we don't have to have it proven to us that there are people listening. After 33 years, I believe somebody is listening. Kind of proud about that. Humbled by the times. Okay, you're going to give your call letters. You're going to give me your call letters and name right now because you've got a question and a comment. And you're going to prove to us that you're not dead asleep because you stayed up around the clock at your local field day site. And I'm going to be asking you guys what would field day like for you later on. K2RAW TechNet, we're listening.
Question, WA2PJS Vito Bayshore.
Yes.
Okay, we had doubles and triples that time, but Vito, WA2PJF is the first name I heard. Eric, KE2EJ was the second name I heard. The other people who got covered up, please give me your callers and name right now. K2RAW listening.
Okay, G2RY, David, yes.
KD2IXP, John, yes.
Okay, I picked up Rich into EO. KC2RY, David, I think it is. Is it Kilo, Charlie 2, Romeo, Yankee? Do I have your full call, David?
Thank you, sir. Kilowatt, George 2, Radio Yankee. Go ahead.
Okay, Kilowatt, George 2, Radio Yankee. We got you, David. ahead.
You got it right, Dick.
Okay, didn't mix that one up. Alrighty, we got more than enough to get going. And don't worry if after we go through this list, if you still got a hot question, we'll pick you up. Okay, Vito, W-A-2-P-J-F. Our man from Home Depot, and our man with lots of history with the Ma Bell system. He's got electronic experience he hasn't even tapped into yet. Vito, what would you like to discuss tonight? You're number one on the runway, W-A-2-P-J-F, and Bayshore, K-2-R-I-W, the TechNet.
Very good. Good evening, Richard, and all listening. K-2-R-I-W, W-A-2-P-J-F. Now, I have a very ridiculous question to ask. In my mind, it's ridiculous because it's probably a very simple answer. It's not technical. Of all the years that I have been listening and participating in Field Day, I've always wondered, and people are going to laugh in the background, say, that guy Vito is really stupid with this question. I don't understand the timing belts and elements and whatever it may be. For example, we start at 2 o'clock here in New York. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean that the next time zone further east of us, or no, I'm sorry, would that be west, I guess? West, would be starting at 1 o'clock, then earlier than that, and the other direction will be later? I don't understand how it works. Is New York set at 2 o'clock, are we the precedent of the time, and everybody bills according to us, or how does that work? I never understood that. I know it sounds crazy. Back to you.
Here, I'm not sure. I'm going to make a guess. You guys can correct me. That's an extremely relevant question, Vito, so stop worrying about it. I am guessing that if we dig deep enough into the rules for Field Day, at the 2 p.m., we would call at 1,400 local, at 4 hours to that, 1,800. I am guessing the rules for the United States for Field Day are we all start at 1,800 Zulu time, Greenwich Mean Time. That's my guess, and it runs for 24 hours. So locally, that's 2 p.m. on Saturday to 2 p.m. on Sunday. But that's really 1,800 hours Zulu time is when it begins. And if we all use Zulu time, then no matter what time zone you're in, I think everybody's starting Field Day in the North American continent at the same time. That's my guess. You guys out there who are smarter and more knowledgeable on this, give me a call that is now and correct me on this. K2RIW listening.
1,800 UTC, 2059 UTC on Sunday.
Okay, what you said was a little bit low in audible, a little bit fast in conversation. I heard the beginning of 1,800 Zulu. Repeat that last message a little slower and a little bit louder, Eric. KE2EJ, our maven who maintains all this equipment on Long Island, K2IW in the TechNet, a local broadcast engineer also. Go ahead, Eric.
K2RW, K2EJ, this should be better. Field Day runs from 1800 Universal Time, or UTC, or Zulu, however you'd like to say it, and it runs through 2059 UTC on Sunday.
Okay, 2059 UTC. That sounds like we start at 2 p.m. local, and it sounds like we stop at 4 p.m. local, is what that sounds like, or 5 p.m. local. And there may be some leeway in there where you can do the setup earlier or the setup at the beginning and then extend the number of hours, and you're supposed to operate only 24 hours in your time window. Give me some more words on that, because that sounds like more than 24 hours beginning to end, but is each group only supposed to use 24 hours of that window of time, Eric? KE2EJ, H2RIW, the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2J. It's a 24-hour period, and right. Set up the day before, you can do that. and it's all a matter of point.
There's a whole bunch of rules that are involved in this. You can set up on Saturday, on the day, in the morning, or you can set up previously Friday. And how you do it changes the way points are given, and the various different aspects of it, when you operate. There's additional bonus points if you do solar power rather than gasoline generated, etc., so on and so forth. So you really got to dig into the rules to get all the exacting, but it's all about the number of points that you can accumulate and add to the contacts that you have, and hopefully you wind up a winner.
And not everyone will agree that the winning is the most number of points and having your club listed as the top of the list in the ARRL reporting. Quite often the winners are the ones who look at the equipment, talk to the people, get into some interesting conversations. To me, that's the strong point. But starting time, 1800 Zulu, Saturday. Stop time, 20.59. That's almost 2100, Sunday. That's a 27-hour window from absolute beginning to absolute end. Depending on how you set up, when you do the setup the day before, or starting exactly at some particular time, and various ways that you do field day. Does each individual field day group choose their favorite 24-hour period during that 27-hour window? Is that approximately what happens, Eric? Because that's a little unclear to me. And I'm asking you some dumb questions also. K2EJ, K2RIW, the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2J, I just pulled up the rules on my cell phone.
Of course, it's so tiny, I can barely see it, but give me a couple of minutes and I'll give you the answer to that.
There's rules for example, there's something called the go-to station, get on the air station. May operate on any field day band, only one transmitted signal to somebody go-to station at any one time. Three VHF stations. By the way, there's just different classes of stations operating. For example, Class A is battery for a club or a non-club portable. Class B is one- or two-person portable. Class C is mobile. Class D is home station. Class E is home station with emergency power. Class F is emergency operations center. As you can see, there's many different ways of doing this. I'm just trying to find the actual, here we go. Class A and B stations, let me let it drop first. Okay, Class A and B stations that do not begin setting up until 1800 UTC Saturday may operate the entire 27-hour field day period. Stations that setting up before 1800 UTC Saturday may only work 24 consecutive hours. No Class or AB station begins to set up earlier than 000 UTC on Friday, and for us it's Thursday afternoon, or evening rather, preceding the field day period, cumulative setup time shall not exceed a total of 24 hours, and on and on. Then we get into entry categories and so on and so forth. K2RIW, K2J.
Fantastic. Thank you, Eric. Well done. So there's a 27-hour window that begins at 2 p.m. local time on Saturday, ends at 6 p.m. local time Sunday. So there's a 27-hour window. It sounds to me like depending on when you guys decide to set up, before 2 p.m. or starting to set up after 2 p.m., you have various 24-hour windows in which you're going to be doing your operation. And I get the impression you maybe can go beyond 24-hour window if you start your setup at 2 p.m. on Sunday. Correction, 2 p.m. on Saturday. So it's obvious, Vito, the timing is a little bit complicated. The hours of starting and stopping and so on, a little bit complicated. You've asked an extremely good question. I bet you 80% of the people within our listening audience feels exactly as you do, Vito. They're not quite sure what's going on. They know it's a lot of fun, and I don't think anybody's going to come and sue you if you happen to operate an extra few minutes beyond the window, and so to speak, and maybe just erase that from the log. So it's a fun operation, but you've asked a darn good question, Vito. You're allowed to ask more questions on the first subject. About time somebody asked that question, Vito. What made you wait this long? WA2PJF. K2RIW, the TechNet. You got it, Vito.
Okay, no one answered my question, but it's okay. All I know is that I remember last year, in particular, a person was calling CQ Field Day a couple of minutes past 2 o'clock, my time here in Bay Shore, and he was scolded. He was told, hey, get off the air. It's over. So, I will never understand how this works. Now, if we're working with 2 or 3 hours beyond the 24-hour period, how is it, and you don't have to even bother to answer this question, how is it I'm not hearing other people calling CQ Field Day? I mean, we're on a low band, we're good for around the world, but at 2 o'clock or there, plus or minus a minute or two, everything just becomes quiet. It's over. It's shut down. So, I don't understand the extra 3 hours, but anyway, I'm tying things up with a stupid question. I was just curious. Back to you, Dick.
Will you ask to that?
Yeah, I'm going to go to Eric first and Paul second, but I have the impression, I'm going to reword Vito's question a little bit. So Eric is going to answer both what Vito said and what I'm about to ask, and that is, it is my impression, Eric, from what you read to us, that if we had chosen at our local Field Day site to begin the antenna setup at 2 p.m. on Saturday, then we're allowed to go considerably beyond 2 p.m. Sunday and still keep operating. We can use the rest of that 27-hour window for our operation. That's my understanding of what I've heard so far. Correct me on this, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ, you're absolutely correct. And actually, most folks, and you'll find most clubs will actually set up either the day before or the morning of and not take advantage of the next 3 hours. I've run a number of years where it's gone to 6 o'clock. There are stations out there that feel it's far between, but there are some that like to start at exactly 2 o'clock, put their antennas up and get on the air. This year is kind of a tough call because the snowing conditions were not all that great, but at 4 o'clock I was hearing people call this year, so it's not unusual, but they're the minority, they're not the majority. And by the way, Vito, everybody starts all at the same, or at least the window starts all at the same time. In all the different time zones in Hawaii and California and then up in Canada, which are the participants in Alaska. So, anybody that's telling you that it starts at different times, at different time zones, is incorrect. And somebody that told you that it's over, is also incorrect. So, back to you, Dick. K2RWK3J.
The real on-air portion of Field Day is 1800 Zulu Saturday is the beginning time, and where Vito heard somebody telling a group, hey, it's beyond 2 p.m. Sunday, you got to get off, it's over, quite possibly that person was in error. If that particular group had decided to start setting up their antennas starting at 1800 Zulu local, they're allowed to go considerably beyond 2 p.m. on Sunday, up to as possibly as late as 6 p.m. on Sunday. That's what our local time, and that happens to be essentially 2100 Zulu. So we got some legalistic mavens out there who are what? I can't think of the right word for it now. But Paul, WS2N, tell us your view on this timing situation, and maybe give us a few words on what your local Field Day was like. WS2N, our space expert, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, Eric pretty much said what I was going to say, because many times you'll hear at the end of Field Day, 2 o'clock, you'll hear people doing exactly what Vito said. And then, you know, if you tune around, you'll pick up a couple of stations that are still on. And one year I did hear somebody make the same comment, you know, Field Day's over, and then somebody came on quite nicely and told the guy that we set up late, you know, and we're allowed to keep going. and then the guy went off and he was gone. So, and as far as my field, I will. I went with my son-in-law, who's also a ham. We went over to Great South Bay for a little while, and then over to Limehawk, and played around with the CW. Back to you, Dick.
I'm going to make one other guess here, Eric, and so, Eric, you can tell me from your point of view if this is possibly right. It sounds to me like a very large percentage of the local Field Day people start setting up considerably before 2 p.m. on Sunday because they want to take their own sweet time setting up these slightly dangerous towers, guiding systems, all kinds of elaborate antennas. They want to take their own sweet time doing it slowly and safely. I am guessing the safety maven at each one of these Field Day sites has got a mental image of people starting their setup at 2 p.m., which means they're now in the active time, and they would sort of start creating a mad rush to put up the antennas in a hurry, and that could create accidents, and therefore a certain percentage of the Field Day sites are not willing to do it that way. They want to start the setup of the antennas considerably before 2 p.m. so that they're able to make the first CQ Field Day at 2 p.m. on Sunday, and all the equipment is up and tied down and confirmed and so on. They don't want that mad rush of doing the setup starting at 2 p.m. Is that approximately what might be going on here, Eric? KE2EJ, KE2LAW, the TechNet.
Well, in my opinion, that's entirely possible. But, you know, safety is one issue, but you also have to consider and understand that many clubs, I mean, here we're fortunate to have large groups of people to put up large antennas on large antenna mounts. And some people are lucky enough to have bucket trucks that can put their antennas on. But the majority of folks, there's other ways of doing antennas a long way, you know, dipole, things of that nature, a little easier. Those are the ones that might do it at 2 o'clock. But there's other things involved, too. Like, you got to get the stuff there, you got to get food for everybody, you got to have shelter so that if it rains, there's a lot of stuff to set up. So people have a tendency to set it up on either Saturday morning or Friday afternoon.
And I think that's the right way to go because some of these setups I've heard about and seen with my own eyes are very elaborate. Limehawk has a very large setup in their town. Also, I can't think of the name of the town. And I have trouble finding it too. Poor Paul. I mean, Eric was telling me they've passed us two or three times driving around looking for the actual site. But when you look at this 85-foot-high bucket truck that the Great South Bay group sets up, wow, rather elaborate things. And so I'd like to do that nice and slow and make sure that we're not cutting any corners on safety. In past years, I've seen people with guide tower arrangements during Field Day that are a little bit on the dangerous side. It scares me a little bit. If somebody climbs that tower with not very well attached ground stakes for the guy wires, it's hard to believe that the guy wires are so darn important in keeping a tower vertical in itself. If it falls over and falls on somebody's tent, that can be very unpleasant. I'm glad to see that most years there are very few reported accidents during Field Day, whereas I think during this last week, one of the prominent amateurs of a very major club, I think in Maryland, was on a tower and fell off and died. So a few of those happen. And even somebody with 10 or 20 years of climbing experience can sometimes make a mistake. Let me drop a quick. When I climb my 100-foot tower, as I've been doing since 1967, I think it was, so I've had 100 feet of tower on two or three different pieces of property since 1967. I wear a safety harness around my waist that has a lanyard going around the tower. I have a second safety harness around my chest that has a lanyard that goes around the tower. So when I climb past a set of guy wires on the tower, opening up one of those lanyards and bypassing the guy wires and then reconnecting that one before disconnecting the other lanyard. And I also wear a so-called cowlick. In other words, another piece of nylon webbing with carabiners coming from my chest. So there's three ways on station. I'm going to stay there for a while and do some work. I'm attached with two lanyards plus a cowlick. I'm attached to the tower in three places. That's my way of doing it. Belt and suspended, so to speak. He's not cutting corners from anything like that. He's doing any climbing, free climbing, with no attachment to the tower. And if you think about it very hard, let me drop it. With no safety attachment during the tower, during the climb, there's one handhold between you and one hell of a big drop. Gravity can really get you down. Just one slip of a hand or a couple of fingers. So the free climb, I mean, and there are cases where my tower has got a certain altitude. It's got quite a few antennas to get past all of those antennas that are attached to the side of the tower with all this connecting and disconnecting of safety devices. It's a bit slow. It takes me two or three times as much time to get past those antennas because I refuse to do it as a free climb. So I've been doing tower work now on my own towers for what? 40 some odd years? Let's see. If it was 1970, 30, 40, 45, 47 years. And I managed to stay alive with lots of hours in the air for 47 years. You got to do those kind of safety things. And another thing I do is I go and tug on each one of the guy wires in each of the corners of the tower before climbing the tower. I'm inspecting the hardware before I do the climb. That's just me. It gives me some confidence. I've got as much fear of height as anyone else. Now let me drop. With all that climbing experience on my 100-foot towers, you would think that by now I'd have no problem. If I spend anything more than half hour or an hour above the 60-foot level on my tower doing work, I'll have the next two nights, I will have mild nightmares of making a mistake and falling off a tower. That's just the way the brain works, so to speak. And so that's the investment I make. I have a fear of heights, and I have some nightmares about it when I do work up there. But I have a lot less a fear of doing it when I know I've got safety equipment that's been pull tested, I've got multiple methods of attachment, and I'm inspecting all the hardware before I do the climb. A real good pilot inspects everything on the airplane before he climbs in and starts the motor. All kinds of, I'm sure there's a boating equivalent of that, of checking all the hardware, checking all the life preservers and so on, before you go out on your boat. Because a number of these hobbies we have some significant danger in them. Now, the next person on the list was Eric, a broadcast engineer with lots of years of experience with computers and computer-generated graphics. How in the world could he have a technical question for this group? Go ahead, Eric. KE2EJ, I'm pulling his leg. K2RW in the TechNet.
K2RW, KE2EJ. Well, this is a physics question, okay? It's more of a little bit of a discussion. Let's talk about electromagnetism, or magnetism in general, and light. Something called the Faraday effect. Are you aware of it?
I'm far from an expert on the subject, Eric, but over the last few years, I've formed some very strong opinions about the way we teach transverse electromagnetic signal transmitting theory and what's really going on. And Faraday's laws are heavily involved. And Kirchhoff's laws, you go to the right Walter Lewin lecture, his YouTube videos of Walter Lewin from MIT, arguably one of the world's best physics instructors. He will convince you that under certain circumstances, Kirchhoff's law is garbage. It's a subset of Faraday's law. Faraday is the real law that's involved with many of the circuits and antennas that we work with. And only under certain conditions, when there is no local, non-conservative magnetic field, can you drop down to the simpler law of Kirchhoff's law. But Faraday is the real bedrock of what's going on with magnetic circuits in free space. KE2EJ, K2RW, that's what Walter Lewin said. You got it, Eric.
Okay, I've tried a number of these experiments, and they're really cool. Let's say you get yourself a big jar, and you fill it up with olive oil. In there, you're going to dump an electromagnet with a reasonable size hole in the middle. Say it's an inch or 2 inches wide. Now what we're going to do is we're going to shoot a beam of light through it, and we're going to energize that electromagnet. Is it going to have any effect on that beam of light?
It's my belief the answer is no, Eric. You're creating a steady state, per se, magnetic field with that electromagnet inside of your jar of olive oil or whatever it is. And so a steady state magnetic field with what we call light, like a laser beam going through it. And by the way, one of the things we discussed today is that why in the world do we call the 14 megacycle region of ham radio, why do we call it 20 meters? Why don't we call it 14 megacycles, 14.215? For a very good classic reason. Back in 1920, with electro wires, you could measure wavelength. Knew that it was a 20 meter wavelength. You had no frequency counters in those days. So you set your frequency by way of a wavelength. At some later time, probably in the 60s, we could count megacycles on a frequency counter. Now we have a much more attractive way of saying where you are on the band. Let me drop. When it comes to optics, for the most part, there is no frequency counter for an optical wave. By various means, you can find out that your eye is operating at 550 nanometers of wavelength. So at light frequencies today, we're still specifying wavelength. And so the middle of the optical band that your eye is operating at, we all have a feeling for what is 600 megahertz. Go 1 million times higher in frequency, and you're at 550 nanometers, where your eye is where we're operating. 10 to the 15 hertz, real high frequency. The day will come and we will have a frequency counter that works up there. So that light is going through your medium at some super high frequency, 10 to the 15 hertz, and there is a steady state magnetic field down there at DC frequency, creating a magnetic field. And is it going to cause any deflection of the light beam? It is my guess the answer is no. But you've done the experiment. Tell me what you saw, Eric. And by the way, you've got to worry about some other secondary effects here. Let me drop this. As you put current through your electromagnet, and there's some IR drop, and you're making some local heat, and the heat waves you're generating with your electromagnet in your jar of fluid, that can create all kinds of deflections, which you might think is magnetic effects, and it might really be a thermal effect. A hell of a lot of fluids, when you heat them up locally, you make all kinds of thermal waves, or local thermals, if you know what I mean, which can create waviness of the light going through, and therefore the effect you think is electromagnetic might really be thermal. How you isolate one from the other would take a whole lot of testing. I mean, when you do an experiment, there's only 10 different ways the experiment can have some errors, and one by one you've got to somehow recognize all those potential errors, do something to check whether or not the error is taking place, and eventually check them all off. So what did you see? Let's hope it wasn't thermal. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, somebody just dropped from the IRLP.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Okay. Well, we're going to need a little help here, because if we're going to have any effect on that beam of light, we need a methodology and the ability the way to see it. So, in essence, what you do is you take, and you need some really good high-quality polarizing filters. At the entrance of the light source, you put a polarizer, and at the exit where you're going to be observing it, you put another polarizer, and you put them on the same plane. So you put them on a 90-degree plane from one another, so it's attenuating, and you get the maximum attenuation there. Now, when you energize the coil, you will see the intensity of the light that's coming through to the second polarizer increase and decrease according to when you have the current on and off. So what we're really doing is we're changing the polarization of the light. Now, I'm totally aware of what you're saying in terms of the medium and the possible thermal effect. We've done it in water. We've done it in open air. Although when you do it in open air, it seems to be less apparent, but it's still there. The effect is still there. Why the differences for the different materials that you're shooting through, I think we're talking some kind of velocity factor here that you can get on my plate. And I have yet to try it with a laser light torch, which is interesting, which I'll get to at some point. But taking all of those different factors into consideration, trying to avoid them by using a fan in the open air to make sure that you're not causing any heating effects. Other little tricks like that. I just found it really interesting. And then, because I was interested in reading about several things optical-wise, getting involved in that for some other reasons, doing some searches on you.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
We only lost the last 3 seconds, Eric. Okay, I was making a guess that you were talking about deflection of beam. Now you're talking about polarization. That's a horse of a different color. As you probably know, there's all kinds of fancy crystals where you put a beam of light through it in one polarization, and what comes out are very different other polarizations by refringence and whatever. On top of that, the last month of, let me think now, was it Microwave Theory and Techniques, Antennas and Propagation Magazine, or was it one of Electronic Design News? Anyhow, there's been a number of articles in the last month on the subject of metamaterials. If you make tiny little resonators in various ways, tiny little microscopic Ohmian strips and whatever, you make tiny little resonators and a whole lot of them in a three-dimensional matrix, a step and repeat diagram of these things, you can generate metamaterials, materials where the signal going through, be it RF, light, or whatever, but most of this is radio experiments these days, you can synthesize materials that Mother Nature never created. Let me drop. Where you can make the dielectric constant of the material a negative number. So that's the permittivity. You can make the mu of the material, the magnetic characteristics, again, a negative number. And if you do the two of them simultaneously, negative dielectric constant, negative permeability, you can now have what they call left-hand medium versus right-hand medium. Get all kinds of crazy effects in polarization and deflection and whatever going on with these synthesized materials. So, your jar of stuff, we've now put a magnetic field through it. Can it affect polarization? And that now I'm more in acceptance that I think you saw the real thing. And if you did it with coherent source, like a laser beam, to take a jar of stuff with magnetic field, by the way, let me link that up. Bragg cells. There are a number of materials where you put a magnetic field through them, and propagation effects change, and polarization effects change. So, making tunable materials, electronically variable materials, boy, there's a whole lot of art and science to that. But these metamaterials, we're now synthesizing dielectric constants and permeabilities that Mother Nature never made. Whoever would think you could make negative permeability or permittivity. It's like having negative temperature. There's been a couple of articles on that too, going below absolute zero. So I think you're onto something here, Eric. What triggered you on this in the first place? KE2EJ, KQRIW, the TechNet.
KQRIW, KE2EJ. Well, I've been looking at trying to do a number of different things. So they're related to making interference patterns to a number of different things. Come up with the thought of using a DMD chip, and actually I came up with a cool idea for the DMD chip to make printed circuit boards, no less. But I've got a friend with an optical flat table, and we've been doing different kinds of experiments, trying to not necessarily record the data on film, but record the data electronically, and then put it back together. And I was just looking for a way to change the axis of the beam of light that is being used for reference. And I only need to change it very, ever so slightly, just to create an interference pattern. And that was just a thought. I mean, I know at RF what we can do there, so why not at light? So let's try it.
Well done. Now, here's a subject that you probably have a lot more knowledge than an awful lot of us have. Liquid crystal displays on many of our computer and handheld devices. I think some of those displays
displays have light reflecting off the display, which is being shifted in polarization as you turn on the electronics on the liquid crystal display. And I think that's part of the mechanism by which you get dark and bright areas, and therefore you can write numbers and make pictures and whatever on your screen. I think in some cases it can even be done with technicolor pictures on that screen. I am guessing that the liquid crystal really contains a fluid with a whole bunch of tiny little particles that when you change the E field, the particles line up in a certain way, and it changes polarization characteristics, and that's something to do with the mechanism of how a portion of the liquid crystal display turns black or white. Give us a few words on that one, Eric, because you're into that field. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, if you were to take a liquid crystal and look at it, and not in its case, you'll find that the liquid crystal is pretty clear, and if you put the appropriate voltages, exactly the AC voltages that goes into making those crystals with, you'll find that when you look at it, it actually has no effect. But when you put the final polarizing filter in front of it, then you see it go dark and light, and the density of dark is based upon the quality of the polarizing filter on the front. And essentially what it does is it rotates the first ones, I think, scattered, and they weren't really very good, but they managed to come up with something that just literally just changes the polarization by something like 20 degrees or something of that nature. I can look it up and be more precise about it, but that's how they work.
If I took one of my computers with a liquid crystal display and put it under my stereo zoom microscope, and I'm now looking at the microscopic level of the fluid and the particles that are in that liquid crystal display, and now I start dialing in dark and bright areas on the display, will I see tiny little particles that line up in certain ways that become polarizers? What will I see under my microscope if I did that experiment, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. I'm trying to remember that, you know, I just looked this up. I'm trying to remember the properties of the liquid crystal itself. Essentially, in one area, you would see the particle. You know, you'd think that it would be a crystal lattice is what you're looking at, but it's not exactly. When you energize it, you will see that lattice very clearly, and when it's not energized, you'll see a randomness to it.
Yeah, I'm wondering if the word liquid crystal leads us to come to the impression of something different. I think a liquid crystal display has a fluid medium with particles in it behind that front screen. And I think those particles line up in certain ways when voltage is applied. I know that some of the liquid crystal display television screens, for instance, when you're watching a picture, and if you put your fingernail against the screen and wipe it across the screen, temporarily you'll see a streak because you've disturbed the fluids where your finger has scraped across the screen, and very rapidly it comes back to normal. So I get the impression there's a fluid medium with particles floating into it that are electrotropic, that was by way of voltages or magnetic fields, the properties of the particles in that liquid change, which makes dark and bright areas and color areas. That's my impression, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW, are the crystals the little particles? Because it seems to be a fluid medium inside of that display. You got it, Eric.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Yes, it is totally a liquid medium. That's why when you press on it, you change the way it scatters light. Also, heat affects it. Trying to find something here. I guess looking for the composition of the liquid itself. That was a discovery. I don't remember where. Here we go. Liquid crystal contains, the alignment layer contains ionic compounds. If an electric field of one particular polarity is applied for a long period of time, this ionic material is attracted to the surface. This degrades the device performance. That's why they use alternating current. I don't know if that's not what we're interested in. I'm looking for the actual composition of the liquid. Here we go. Frederick Lenzner discovered the liquid crystalline nature.